All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And Jason Ditt's going to be on the show today. As well as Phil Giraldi. Straighten out some things about who's supporting which terrorists in Iran. I want to know, don't you? Well, hopefully Phil will have some good answers for us. Man, there's a lot of hype about war with Iran lately. And I wish that I believed that it was just, you know, kind of a wink nod thing between, you know, Republican-tied oil companies and their Iranian friends where they just pretend to not like each other to drive up the price of oil on the short term. So you gotta admit, they pretend they're gonna go to war with Iran all the time. They never do. They talk mad. I don't know how to talk without cussing. They try really hard all the time to hype up all the reasons we gotta have war. I'm just sitting here debunking the same damn lies for years and years on end. It's funny how I don't really get bored. But anyway, there's been a lot of hype about a possible war with Iran. And, you know, Phil Giraldi's been on the cutting edge of this story for a long time. He's got one today at antiwar.com called What War with Iran Might Look Like. Or maybe it's from yesterday, I forget. Hit refresh here. His new one is about creating American terrorists. That's different. His last one is What War with Iran Might Look Like. And it's a slippery slope kind of an argument, but it points out a real danger, not necessarily a likelihood, but at least a real danger that a war with Iran could in fact spread to World War III. And that doesn't mean that Russia and China will declare war on America if America bombs Iran. But what it does mean is that wars and regime changes never really survive. The battle plan never survives the first engagement. And that it could just escalate and escalate. And of course, the most dangerous nuclear flashpoint in the world isn't between Israel and Iran, because everybody knows that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons. The most dangerous flashpoint for nukes in the world is the border, the relationship between India and Pakistan. And that's the kind of thing that could get out of hand real quick if the government of Pakistan fell for being the puppets of the Americans who are bombing Iran, for example. And then, what the hell do I know about it? But from what I heard, the policy in China is that they will not allow a clear-cut Indian victory over Pakistan, their ally. And China's got enough nukes to do something about it. Although, geez, try to stay out of a nuclear war if you can, guys. But anyway, this is the kind of thing that they're messing with over there. And I don't know if John Glazer's right. John Glazer on the show yesterday really talked about, he thinks that Obama's got this thing on autopilot as far as foreign policy. Just turn it over to Hillary and the generals. And they just really think they can meddle anywhere and do anything. For example, bomb Pakistan till it ceases to exist as a monopoly force there. And, you know, create the danger of loose nukes in the hands of people willing to use them, who are not quite as disciplined as generals who typically don't use nukes. But, I think you could have a war with Iran that would be a disaster that fell far short of that. Doesn't have to be that bad to be way too bad to get in it. And it's a really interesting article. I mean, it really goes through detailing threats to shipping in the Gulf and, of course, the Fifth Fleet at Bahrain and, for that matter, the kingdom, the puppet dictatorship kingdom of Bahrain that little did you know you own. And Karzai's life in Afghanistan, NATO's mission there. The embassy in Iraq. The price of oil. The global depression. It's pretty much all there. All for picking on a helpless third world country, really. I mean, I'm not trying to run the people there down. All individuals are individuals, man. They're just as great as you. But I'm just saying, as far as their state's ability to wage war, you know, John Glazer had an article the other day about how Iran is too weak to defend itself from American and Israeli terrorism. Whoever's killing all these scientists and whatever. Apparently the Iranian version of the FBI can't do a thing about it. They're pathetic. But they're just powerful enough. They're just powerful enough to defend themselves effectively. That's what they are. They're no offensive threat to Israel or the United States. Not in a million years. And of course, here it is in the Washington Post. The Israeli army says that a nuclear Iran could deter Israeli military action against Hamas and Hezbollah. Periodically, we want to bomb the helpless in the Gaza Strip. But if the Iranians have nukes, then we could be deterred from doing so. So we can't have that. Thanks for the plain English there, guys. We appreciate it when you admit the truth about your evil lies and motives. If we are forced to do things in Gaza or in Lebanon under the Iranian nuclear umbrella, it might be different. It might be different. Said Military Planning Division Chief Major General Amir Eshel of the Israeli Defense Forces. Israel itself is assumed to have a large stockpile of nuclear weapons, and unlike Iran, it has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Can you believe I just read that paragraph out of the Washington Post? Wow. That was really something. Israel has nukes, and they're not a member of the NPT like the Iranians are. Wow. All right. Wow. So there you go. There's your Iranian nuclear threat, as MJ Rosenberg pointed out after the Iowa caucus, when Ron Paul came out and gave his most excited speech ever about the movement toward more liberty. Mitt Romney came out and said the number one thing wrong with America is that Barack Obama has not gone to war with Iran yet, and when I'm president, I will. That was Romney's thing. That's what he says is the most important thing to do, is to get us into a conflict with this country that is, in fact, like the Washington Post happened to report in this one instance, a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, with all of their nuclear materials safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And therefore are, that's it. No fissile material, no nuclear weapons. Get it? Right. Zero fissile material means zero nuclear weapons. I knew you could understand that. I know nuclear technology is very sophisticated and everything, but still, right? No fissile material, no nuclear weapons. Okay. And otherwise, they are basically helpless. They are just powerful enough to defend themselves, to shoot a few supersonic missiles at the American Navy, at Saudi oil. They have just enough money in their covert operations to mount some coup d'etats and some uprisings and some mischief and trouble in America's puppet lily pad states across Eurasia. And they could. It's amazing, isn't it, the kind of consensus that can be built over things that ain't right. Like, we need to have a war because, as the Israeli military says, they want to be able to start wars whenever they feel like, without the threat of anyone ever being able to fight back against them. And America must turn the world upside down for them if that's what they want. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And I got to talk more about Ron Paul on this thing here. It's just amazing to me. I can't get over it. I mean, look, back when he was just that one good congressman that a few of us were big fans because we were libertarians and so is he. Of course, you give him a blackout. Yeah, he gets on Washington Journal every once in a while and sticks up for the Branch Davidians and stuff like that. And nobody cares except a few of us. But now he's Ron Paul, man. He ran for president last time. He did 10,000 cable TV news interviews between presidential runs. And given a hell of a lot of speeches that ended up all over YouTube and all that kind of thing since then. He's built this huge organization for his campaign. He virtually tied, but maybe that's too generous, but he got a damn respectable third place in Iowa, a strong second in New Hampshire, where Mitt Romney has a house, where he's been buying votes since forever. And everybody was all hyping up, oh, Huntsman's on the march, it's Huntsman's night and all this. Yeah, right. And he got an 11-point boost right off the bat in South Carolina. And now you got all this bad news breaking about Newt Gingrich. About, I'm not going to pick on him for marital things. Lord knows it's hard to have personal relationships with people sometimes. But, being a right-wing, warmongering, hypocrite, pretend Christian, conservative, whatever. I guess the hypocrisy angle there might be valid. But, and then the headline is that Mitt Mentum, as they're calling it right now on MSNBC, is going nowhere. That Mr. Presumed frontrunner, the Hillary Clinton of 2012, go ahead and coronate him because we don't even need to have primaries or caucuses this year because we all know that she is going to be the nominee. Mitt Romney's going nowhere. Nobody likes him. I mean, there are people with money who know that he could be a reliable figurehead, but people aren't, buying the figurehead thing. They know he would do their bidding. But the people aren't going for the sales pitch this time. And so, never mind how much I like Ron Paul. He's up against the scum of the earth over here. I mean, give us a break, please. And yet, MSNBC all morning long, oh my God, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum. Rick Perry dropped out, endorsed Newt Gingrich. So that means it's down to Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum. Really? I'm pretty sure that's an outright lie. Guys, come on. You're going to really cover the Republican primary race in South Carolina for better than an hour anyway. And you're just going to not say the name of the guy in third at all. Like, do they really have, like, a morning huddle, like a police show on TV where they have, the commissioner or whatever, the major gives them all their marching orders before they go out there? And they really have a little meeting like that, and they just say, anyone says the name Ron Paul, you're fined $10,000. Just, he will not be on our channel today, period. You got that? Or what? How does that work? They all have to, like, wear a dark cloak and clutch a sword and a torch and do some weird ceremony and pledge their fealty to some malevolent god? Or is it just, hey, guys, no Ron Paul on the channel today, okay? We are just going to not talk about the guy that's running a strong third place. A guy who, is telling the people of South Carolina he will bring their sons home from the no-win wars where their lives are being risked and wasted for nothing. That might be tempting to them. He's telling them that it's okay to just go ahead and support a conservative Republican from Texas who himself is a veteran of the Air Force, who himself does nothing but invoke the Founding Fathers and their Constitution and their red, white, and blue all damn day, who wants to bring their boys home. Wait a minute. My cognitive dissonance is easing. This was the I had a much more cynical take yesterday. You might have heard it, where the Wall Street Journal said, oh my God, half of conservatives in America who call themselves conservatives are basically buying the Ron Paul line here. In fact, I think I mentioned that on the show yesterday. I really thought that the way the questions were worded was just so ridiculous that to have to choose to agree with one of them more than the other was just a problem. So it's not that all conservatives are hardcore Ron Paulian, but more or less, are you sick and tired of the wars? More or less, yeah, half of conservatives. Who? What else does a conservative have to define their beliefs other than their four wars? I mean, we all saw what happened between 2001 and 2009. They all sacrificed each and every one of the things that they had pretended to believe in all along, and with vigor. They put aside all conservatism in favor of that famous red state fascism that lets torture Jose Padilla out of his mind and cackle about it and say it's fair conservatism. Yes, we're torturers for limited government. We want a limited constitutional republic that pretends that there's nothing in there other than the Commander-in-Chief Clause that says the President is the commander and he can command. And that's it. That's the Constitution. But we want to really... We're strict constructionists when it comes to the President is the commander of everything clause. Fifth Amendment? No. Never heard of it. The Eighth? An outright ban on torture in the Bill of Rights. Nah. Forget that. How about anything like conservatism? No, they called it compassion to expand welfare in every way they could and expand regulations. Oh, deregulation. Yeah, right. Like Sarbanes-Oxley, right? The biggest, most regulations ever since Nixon or something. Ted Kennedy's nationalization of schooling, which, you know, the teachers and the parents across the country have rebelled against. And everybody knows that's what's wrong with education is all the standardized testing. All they do is teach them how to take the test, and then they don't even learn that, and then it's all horrible and they can't even read. Because the national government took it over. Because George Bush and Rick Santorum went along with Ted Kennedy's plan to further nationalize education. Call it No Child Left Behind. And then expanding all the Medicare and all that, running trillions and trillions of dollars in deficits and debts. I mean, I know Barack Obama is like September 11th to Bush's Oklahoma City bombing when it comes to spending, man. It's just out of control. But you look at what George Bush did with spending in his 8 years in power. It's really an incredible thing. And so to see conservatives now saying maybe they want a few of those principles they had previously sacrificed back, I could see why it would make people with power panic, you know? Like the arms manufacturers who own NBC that I've been watching all morning, for example. I'm just saying, their slip is showing, that's all. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking, well, introducing Jason Ditz. He's our news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. Jason, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. Let me make sure I got you turned up loud enough here. All right. I've kind of been out of it, and I haven't had much chance to study this thing. I basically only know the sort of TV summary version. I was wondering if you could teach me, and then therefore also any listeners who don't already know about it, about this SOPA bill. And apparently it's been stopped, right? Am I even pronouncing this damn thing right?
Well, it's been stopped for the time being, but a lot of its proponents, particularly the lobbying groups, the MPAA and the RIAA, which are the Motion Picture Association of America and the Recording Industry Artists of America, I believe, have been condemning yesterday's protests by a lot of websites and are saying they're still going to try to push this thing through eventually.
Okay, now, what exactly is the big deal about this law?
Well, on the surface, it broadens the powers of the federal government to shut down websites that are suspected of dealing in copyright infringement. And essentially, we saw the Department of Homeland Security take a stab at basically what this is trying to legalize last year and the year before that, when they shut down several websites that they said were selling, for instance, counterfeit NFL jerseys, that one of them was selling scarves that they said weren't authentically made by the companies they said they were made from. One, they also shut down a Spanish soccer website that the Spanish government had refused to shut down. And the way they did this was by seizing the domain name servers for that and rerouting them to a different website that says this website has been seized.
Mm-hmm.
Domain name servers are when you type in, for instance, antiwar.com, that's how your computer finds antiwar.com's server.
Mm-hmm.
So if the federal government took over the name antiwar.com, even if our server is still up, typing that in isn't going to bring up our server anymore.
Mm-hmm. And so this law was basically going to say that what DHS was trying to do, and I guess succeed in doing in a few cases, would be the standard practice. What, like there was no ceiling on this thing? I mean, because, look, anybody who, that means anybody emails a song to their friend or whatever, everybody would be enforceable, I guess, under this. Is that basically the problem?
Oh, absolutely. And even if you didn't do anything wrong, just the suspicion that you did something wrong would be reason enough for the Justice Department under this law to shut you down.
Well, I think I've even heard of, like, you know, just amateur people, you know, guy with a guitar plays a song, whatever, and then these industry groups basically claim the right to collect royalties on their behalf and that kind of thing. So even if I record my buddy, maybe even email him a copy of a recording I made of him playing a guitar, we're both felons now, that kind of crap. Is that basically what they're going for?
Well, that seems to be the long-term goal. This bill
sets
a little...
Well, this is just to take our stuff, not prosecute us, right?
Right. This is more about shutting down possible competition than anything. It would be incredibly dangerous for websites like YouTube, which is why Google has been so so strongly against the bill. Basically, the first time Disney or Verizon or any company says, "Oh, they're violating our copyright," the Justice Department could shut all of YouTube down over it.
Hmm. Well, you know, I read a couple of headlines anyway that said that, I guess, kind of trying to follow the slippery slope and the chilling effect and all those kinds of phrases, that basically what they're trying to do is turn it back into ABC, CBS, and NBC one-way internet, like the good old days before the internet.
Well, that certainly does seem to be the direction that it's headed in. I'm sure it adds a few more people than that, but...
who can afford the copyright on everything or afford an army of lawyers to protect them when the government comes for them, right? I mean, that's basically, it's sort of like the airwaves. The government basically makes the licenses so expensive and the regulations so incredible that you have to be an arms manufacturer in order to afford to put together something like NBC, you know?
Well, right. It turns freedom of speech on the internet into something that you have so long as you have enough money to legally back it up. And
Wow.
the the big complaint from a lot of people is that the process through which they're doing this is identical to the way the Chinese government has set up their internet. It's, they have these big master lists of sites that are blacklisted, and that every internet provider in the United States would have to block people from being able to visit any of these websites.
Well, and already they've kind of deputized all the internet service providers, right? And kind of require that they keep all kinds of information and all sorts of things, no?
Well, right. They've been doing this as far as surveillance of individual internet users, but this would expand it into restricting content from those users as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I guess the way I understand this thing, it just seems crazily unenforceable without just, you know, shutting the internet off like they could never get away with. I mean, I don't know. I don't really understand what they were going for here, honestly.
It is sort of hard to imagine that they would be able to do what the bill empowers them to do, which, you're right, pretty much would shut down large portions of the internet, and it would make things like message boards virtually impossible to run, because anytime you run a message board, there's always the risk that somebody's going to post infringing material, and that's going to be used as an excuse to shut down the entire website.
And this country needs to read some Stephen Kinsella.
Right.
Well, now, okay, so I don't want to sell them too short, but I guess I'm going to have to. Tell us about the pushback on this. The American people and their awesome democracy actually scored at least a temporary victory here, huh?
Right. When this bill was proposed, it was pushed by those industry associations, the usual Hollywood industry associations. And as usual, because those associations are big donors to a lot of these congressmen, there were just a huge number of co-sponsors for these bills. Now, we've had protests sort of all along from people saying, hey, this is a really awful bill and it can't possibly become law. Yesterday we saw, I believe it was 7,000 different websites blacked out by their owners to protest the possibility of this law passing, and we've seen a lot of the congressmen, including several of the ones that co-sponsored it, backing off entirely and saying they're going to vote against it if it ever comes up to a vote.
Yeah, it's like Ron Paul says, one good thing about them having no principles is if you threaten to take their job away, they might react to that. All right, hold it right there, everybody. It's Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I am talking with Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. And now, Jason, I'd like to ask you about Obama's and America's great victory in Libya. How's things going over there?
Well, not too well, and perhaps unsurprisingly so. Libya's sort of become the mess that we all figured it would be in the wake of this civil war. There's no real central government despite all of NATO's backing of the NTC, and a lot of these different militia groups that have been armed and funded both by NATO and by just looting all the former regime's weaponry have been fighting amongst themselves.
Well, is NATO, I guess, mostly meaning the French and the British, are they even really trying still to build a puppet government there? Or is there even a plan in effect here? Or are they just waiting until people get tired of killing each other or things get worse or better? Or what are they doing?
It honestly doesn't seem like they have a plan, at least not on the surface. It seems like they're just hoping that the situation will eventually work itself out.
Well, does this National Transitional Council have any kind of real authority other than what's been handed to them by NATO?
Very
I mean, that
little,
anyone would respect other than having a gun straight to their head at the time, you know?
Very little, and I would say what support they had, they lost most of it when they announced their cabinet and cut the Islamist side of the rebellion entirely out of their government.
Well, so that's the fighting then. And now, let's see, because I remember before they finally killed Gaddafi, we talked about how, well, and then so once the regime falls, then you'll have the people who were the pro-Gaddafi holdouts, then you'll have the people who were the used-to-be Gaddafi guys, but then were defectors before the end of the regime, and then you'll have the rebels, and then these will be the three main groups fighting, and then, of course, within the rebels, you have the Islamists and, I don't know, whoever else is left over after that. Does it look like anybody has the upper hand in this thing?
It really doesn't. And in fact, we're seeing a lot of fighting that's not really along ideological lines so much as geographic lines.
Mm-hmm.
We see militias that are this town's anti-Gaddafi militia, and then the town 20 miles over is anti-Gaddafi militia. And these towns have had long-time rivalries for whatever reason, and all of a sudden one of the militias attacks the other town and says they're going to arrest a bunch of people for being Gaddafi supporters, and then a big gunfight breaks out.
Man, yeah, well, it's all, you know, tribal society there. I guess that's how it's going to be. But then, so is Houston getting away with the oil, or who's getting the oil? If all this blood's going to be shed, what's the silver lining?
Well, that seems to be NATO's hope. In fact, the U.S. just yesterday, the State Department was talking about the oil embargo they're trying to push on Iran. And they were saying, well, a lot of this oil that, to replace what we're going to block from coming out of Iran is going to come out of Libya.
Well, you know, Greg Palast said that back in 2002, the coup against Chavez in Venezuela wasn't even about him. It was about Saddam Hussein had called Gaddafi and said, hey, let's raise the price of oil. I forget if it was supposed to go up or down that week, and they wanted to go the other way. And so they did the coup against Venezuela because Hussein was still out of reach for another year, you know?
Right, and it seems like for the southern states in the European Union, the ones that get a lot of oil from Iran, like Greece, it seems incredibly dangerous for them to all of a sudden say, okay, we're going to completely cut off our trade with Iran and put all our eggs in the basket that Libya is going to be stable enough that we can actually buy oil from them reliably.
Yeah.
It seems like sooner or later these rival towns that are saying, well, this is our oil field, because these oil fields aren't anywhere near the towns. They're just out in the middle of the desert, and you've got pipelines running to them.
Yeah.
These towns are going to start blowing up one another's pipelines just to claim the oil for themselves.
Well, I mean, it's no secret why Greece went along. They had to. Ben Bernanke was standing there with a checkbook talking about, y'all want to starve to death or what? So they said, yeah, do whatever, I guess. But, yeah, well, okay, so it does make much more sense, you know, besides just a PR stunt to try to pretend that America's, you know, Uncle Sam is not the backer of every king and sultan and emir and tortured dictator pretend president in the region, that they thought, man, we really need to have a very pliant new government in Libya by the time we get the war going in Iran, because Lord knows we lost Iraq. That's what they call strategery there in Washington, D.C. You know, a friend of mine, Jason, was telling me a story about her dad sent home early from heart surgery with just over-the-counter painkillers. And, like, man, when all the anesthesia wore off, he, like, damn near had a whole other heart attack in his living room. Like, man, he should have still been in the hospital kind of thing. And these are the doctors who we all look up to and respect and have all this education and are wise and smart and all these things. And yet, they screw up and make terrible decisions all the time, and really, that's what Hillary Clinton is, and that's what these people are. Even if they're trying up there, the best that they can do is not good enough, right? They're just schmucks, just like the doctor that you had a bad experience with. You know what I mean? That's what they remind me of, anyway. I could totally see Hillary Clinton going, oh, yes, well, I'm here, look at my white coat, and I'm telling you what's going on here, but really, she doesn't know because she's not even asking the right question, you know?
Well, and this involvement is sort of the unnecessary surgery of that analogy.
Yeah, exactly. Oops, cut off your wrong foot. Didn't mean to do that. Well, and so what about the death toll here? Because, you know, once they murdered Gaddafi on the side of the road, Hillary Clinton style again, you got to love that, man, just her laughter and all that on that occasion. Once they killed Gaddafi, that was it. He ain't been on TV, or that whole war hadn't been on TV since then. It's over as far as the American media is concerned. You know, the involvement has got to continue on here, right? I don't know.
Well, it has to at this point. Certainly, if not directly by the United States, then by a lot of these European Union nations, which are desperate to get that oil out of Libya. I mean, countries like Italy's national oil company has traditionally done a lot of business in Libya. They were doing business during the Gaddafi era, and now they're planning to do business under the NTC era.
Yep. Well, of course, BBC's reporting today that one of these militia leaders was tortured and killed in detention, as they call it, as a taste of the new regime there, not much different than Gaddafi's, which, you know, as everyone knows, I think, Gaddafi had a great relationship with the CIA, torturing people to death for them, and of course they even murdered Sheikh al-Libi for them in his cell and called it a suicide, the guy that Dick Cheney specifically had tortured in order to make him come up with lies about Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda and chemical weapons back in 2003. It was one of the leaders of the revolution is suing the British for cooperating in the CIA rendition and torture.
Right, Abdul Hakim Belloc.
Yeah, Belloc, there you go. Yeah, the guy that Pepe Escobar broke that story, that he was the real military leader hiding in the mountains out there while, as Michael Scheuer predicted, yeah, the CIA are talking to people, the people who will talk to them. That doesn't mean they know what the hell's going on for the people who have the power and influence. Oh, man. Well, I guess we'll see how that one plays out. How about Bahrain or Yemen, man? Give me some Yemen news, Jason.
Well, the latest news out of Yemen was earlier this week they were rumoring that they were going to delay the election, the presidential election, which seems ridiculous because there's only one candidate. But they were saying that security is so bad in the country that they didn't think they could hold a credible election, even a credible one-candidate election.
and that one candidate is the handpicked successor of the former dictator?
Right, and it's the U.S.-backed Major General, Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi.
All right, well, we're out of time, but thanks very much for your time, Jason. Appreciate you helping me catch up here.
Sure, thanks for having me.
The great Jason Ditz, everybody. That's news.antiwar.com. We'll be right back. Well, here in a few, anyway. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Anti-War Radio. I guess I ain't gonna hear back from Pepe Escobar. I don't know. I still got a little while. Philip Giraldi will be on the show later on to talk about Israel and America using al-Qaeda like terrorists to murder Iranians. What the hell is up with all of that? Of course, there's a big story at foreignpolicy.com by this guy Perry, and I forgot which was the big story he'd broken before and how I heard of this guy. It seems like it was something important. But anyway, he wrote this story that said that basically we've been wrong here on this show, I think, that the CIA was backing Jandala and or MEK, I don't know, inside Iran to kill all these scientists and whoever else. It was Israel doing it all along. And the Israelis lied to the Jandala guys and pretended to be Americans. Did it as a false flag. And right under the nose of the Americans, and in a way that really pissed off the CIA guys who were monitoring the whole thing, according to the story. Gareth Porter came on the show yesterday, said, yep, I think it's right. I think that the Israelis told Jandala that, yep, we're CIA, all right? And Jandala went and bragged to the whole world about it, and then that's how it got back into the media here. I ain't so sure of that. Because I don't think Jandala's started rumors were the basis for Hirsch's reporting on that. And if I understood it right, Phil Giraldi himself said on the show a couple of weeks ago that with the new findings passed by Barack Obama, signed by Barack Obama, ordering stepped up covert action in Iran and in Syria, that these were basically escalations of this same program of backing the Mujahideen, Kalk, Jandala, PJAK, the Kurdish communist rebels up there in northern Iraq, across the border there. And according to Phil, apparently some Azeri groups, they're trying to bankroll them and get them to, you know, strengthen secessionist pressure and whatever in the north of Iran. A scientist was exploded to death. And you know what? It seems like, you know, I always said my flaw was that I can't seem to get desensitized, but that's really not true. I really am just like the rest of y'all. We're like, oh yeah, America and or Israel murdered some scientist in Iran. Well, could be worse, right? You know? Whatever. But just think for a minute. Seriously, just think if Iran was assassinating Israeli scientists in Tel Aviv. Or if Iran had secret agents. I mean, just think of how they flipped out over that ridiculous, make-believe, pretended, obvious entrapment plot by the FBI that was supposedly an Iranian plan to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States. You notice how they quit talking about that. You'd think that they'd be trying harder to beat them over the head with it if there was really anything to it at all. I guess it'll continue to come up from time to time, because even though it was debunked in, you know, major newspapers, as well as the alternative media, not so much on TV. And so they'll probably continue to bring it up from time to time as one of their talking points against Iran. But you can tell the administration didn't make that big of a deal out of it, at least publicly. Apparently they signed a new finding. But just think, if in real life, not in some ridiculous FBI DEA entrapment plot involving a drunken idiot Alzheimer's patient used car salesman. Well, he wasn't really an Alzheimer's patient, but they say he was very forgetful. Anyway, and a bunch of DEA agents who'd infiltrated the Zetas drug cartel down in Mexico. I thought it was the Sinaloa. So America backs both sides of the drug war, the big drug war between the Sinaloa and the Zetas cartels down there. Is that how that works? Anyway. But just think if that was real. Just think if the Iranians really did have not just plans, but would, if they really carried out assassinations, especially of our nuclear scientists, guys who work at Los Alamos on splitting and then fusing atoms together. We'd go to war against them immediately. Can you imagine the outrage? Seriously. Just for 1 minute. Put the shoe on the other foot. If Iran was assassinating Israeli or American scientists in our countries, no way. But then for the same thing to happen to Iran, meh. That's life. That's what you get for living in Persia, guys. It's just how it is. And you know, the blowback is already apparent. It's in the, I think it was the Associated Press yesterday. A bunch of kids are switching, and I'm sure there's some Iranian government propaganda to this, but I'm sure there's a good kernel of truth, too. Kids are switching their majors. They're like, hey, I'm pretty good at math. I'll be a nuclear scientist. How do you like that? Young people are so brazen, you know? There is, by the way, basically unanimous support for the civilian nuclear electricity and medicine program that exists in Iran. They all like it, including the revolutionary green movement and all that. But anyway, more like that coming up. Right now, here's a little bit of Ron Paul on the subject of the NDAA thingamajig.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
It was yesterday.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to introduce a very simple piece of legislation to repeal the infamous Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, quietly signed into law by the President on New Year's Day. What a way to usher in the new year. Section 1021 essentially codifies into law the very dubious claim of presidential authority under 2001 authorization for the use of military force to indefinitely detain American citizens without access to legal representation or due process of law. Section 1021 provides for the possibility of the U.S. military acting as a kind of police force on U.S. soil, apprehending terror suspects, including Americans, and whisking them off to an undisclosed location indefinitely. No right to attorney, no right to trial, no day in court. This is precisely the kind of egregious distortion of justice that Americans have always ridiculed in so many dictatorships overseas. A great man named Solzhenitsyn became the hero of so many of us when he exposed the Soviet Union's extensive gulag system. Is this really the kind of a United States we want to create in name of fighting terrorism? Some have argued that nothing in Section 1021 explicitly mandates holding Americans without trial, but it employs vague language, radically expanding the detention authority to include anyone who has substantially supported certain terrorist groups or associated forces. No one has defined what those terms mean. What is an associated force? Sadly, too many of my colleagues are too willing to undermine our Constitution to support such outrageous legislation. One senator even said about American citizens being picked up under this section of the NDAA, quote, "When they say, I want a lawyer, you tell them, shut up. You don't get a lawyer," close quote. Is this acceptable in someone who has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution? Mr. Speaker, of course, I recognize how critical it is that we identify and apprehend those who are suspected of plotting attacks against Americans. But why do we have so little faith in our judicial system? Have we not tried in civilian court and won convictions of hundreds of individuals for terrorist or related activities?
All right, y'all, let's answer War Radio. Hang on a minute. We'll be right back.
Continuing to do so. But let us not.
All right, y'all. It's Anti-War Radio. Here's some more of this Ron Paul, current presidential candidate on the House floor, introducing his bill to repeal the section of the most recent defense appropriations bill, which basically legalizes the power that Barack Obama and George W. Bush have claimed since 2001. Bush, based on magic or God or plenary inherent authority buried somewhere in the Commander-in-Chief Clause. Obama, more simply, has relied on the congressional authorization to use force against Al-Qaeda passed right after September 11th as the basis for his claim. But both of them have claimed the power to basically do the Padilla thing to any of us. And that is, even if you're arrested by FBI civilian police in blue parkas, that they can turn you over to the military and the CIA to be tortured if they feel like it. that the whole world is a battlefield, and anywhere there's a battlefield, there's no law that can bind the power of the President of the United States of America. That's their theory. And Ron Paul is calling them out, and he's calling on the Congress to repeal that section. And obviously there's a hell of a lot more in his Freedom Agenda Act from before, but this is one specific one, and a great speech, and here he is. Did he say Lindsey Graham by name? He's clearly at least referring to Lindsey Graham, calling him out, the senator from North Carolina, right? For basically talking like a ridiculous kid about, ha-ha, shut up, you don't get a lawyer, you're a terrorist, yeah, you're going to jail.
I recognize how critical it is that we identify and apprehend those who are suspected of plotting attacks against Americans. But why do we have so little faith in our judicial system? Have we not tried in civilian court and won convictions of hundreds of individuals for terrorist or related activities? I fully support continuing to do so. But let us not abandon what is so unique and special about our system of government in the process. I hope my colleagues will join my effort to overturn this shameful section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. And I yield back.
Chair recognizes the gentlelady from Texas, Ms. Jackson Lee, for 5 minutes.
All right. Well, so anyway, there's that. Yeah, last chance for your Bill of Rights there. You'll never have another chance to get your Bill of Rights back. You see that? That wrong track that America's on? It's called fascism. It's called the end of the pretension of fairness in government process for taking your liberty away. Here's more.
Yield 3 minutes to the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Paul.
Gentleman from Texas is recognized for 3 minutes.
I thank the gentleman for yielding. I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
Without objection, the gentleman is recognized.
Madam Chairman, we're here today to try to prevent the national debt from going up another $1.2 trillion. But in a way, it's a formality because most everybody knows the national debt is going up $1.2 trillion. And this is sad because this process is a really very mixed effort to try to curtail spending. And this power to the president to ask for a debt increase, and then we have to get two-thirds of the Congress to prevent this from going up, this is a creature of Congress. It's also a creature of a mental status here in the Congress of overspending on just everything. And it'd be nice if we could blame everything on the current administration or even the previous administration. But the crisis that we're in has been building over a long period of time, and it's very bipartisan. There's been way too much cooperation in this Congress because those who like spending cooperate, and they keep spending it. And for a long time, we were able to get away with this because we were a very wealthy country. Now we're non-productive. The good jobs are overseas, and yet the spending is escalating exponentially. We're really not facing up to the reality that the problem is spending. Yes, we have to deal with the debt, but the debt is a consequence of too much spending. Where do we spend too much money? In two places, overseas and domestically. And we need to stop the spending. You know, it's really, in my mind, it started about 40 years ago when there was a guarantee that you don't have to worry about debt because we always had somebody there to buy the debt. If we'd have had a market rate of interest where you didn't have the Federal Reserve buying the debt, interest rates would go up and would force us to live within our means. As long as you have a Federal Reserve there with no linkage to anything of soundness since 1971, the Congress has been reckless and the deficits had continued to grow. And the crisis that we're facing today is an inevitable consequence. I believe we're in denial here in the Congress. If we had the vaguest idea of how serious this crisis is financially, not only for us but for the world, we'd cut spending. Because you can't solve the problem of debt by accumulating more debt. It's just impossible to do this. And one other thing that I think we fail to do on both sides of the aisle is really cut spending overseas. It is considered that if you spend more money overseas,
you have more defense. And there's no truth to that. Just spending over $1 trillion a year overseas doesn't necessarily give you more defense. And yet nobody's willing to cut. Some of these automatic cuts that are supposed to be in line, that come out of the super committee, everybody's squirming already. How are we going to prevent these cuts? And this pretense that we might cut $1 trillion over the next 10 years is total pretense. We're in total denial that it's cutting something. There's a proposed increase baseline budgeting of $10 trillion. And we're going to cut $1 trillion over 10 years. That's $100 billion a year. Our national debt is going up $100 billion a month. So it's really a charade. But the American people know it's a charade. They're tired of it. They've heard about this for so long. And we need to make up our minds. Are we going to live within the confines of the Constitution, cut the spending and balance the budget, and get out of this mess?
Man, y'all people better make him the president, because if you don't, I'm going to miss his House floor speeches so bad. Isn't he great on the House floor? Man, what in the hell are y'all doing? That's what's cool is, you know, if humanity survives, that is, assuming the American government doesn't destroy all humanity with their hydrogen bombs, and the human race lives on into the future, then this man and his speeches will live on in the Federal Register, whatever, of the that great experiment where at least they sort of kind of were trying to do the individual liberty thing there in the middle part of North America for a little while kind of thing, and they'll have his speeches better than any Roman senator warning of the end and whatever back in the days of the fall of their republic and their empire. He does, man. As, you know, on each and every issue, he makes Thomas Jefferson look like Benito Mussolini. It's classical liberalism perfected. After all, what's to conserve? If American conservatives are meaning to conserve Americanism or whatever, then you mean Jefferson and Madison and their legacy of trying to incorporate a real natural rights doctrine into a system of government here. If you gotta have one, which they mistakenly concluded they had to have one. But still, man, here it is. Silver platter, peace and liberty and a sound economy right here in front of your face. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And, yeah, I'm having fun with this, Republican, race for the presidency or whatever. You got the best congressman ever versus just the worst hacks. I mean, Newt Gingrich, for God's sake, man. In fact, I just think it's great. Like, here's one poll anyway, has Gingrich now ahead of Romney in South Carolina. If he wins, that'll hurt Romney. But then Gingrich isn't going nowhere. I told y'all a year ago or two or six or something. I told you in 07 and 08, right? We joked about this. Newt Gingrich talking about maybe forming an exploratory committee or whatever. And he heard back a resounding, you are a big fat-headed bully and nobody likes you. Don't bother. And so he didn't bother. He actually pulled the same stunt in, I forget if it was in 2004 or 2000. I guess it would have been 2004. He talked about, maybe I'll run a little. No, not against Bush. So it must have been 2000. And everybody had just told him, no, dude, no, we don't like you. Now, here he is. The warmongers, man, they got to go somewhere. And they keep trying to figure out who they can hitch their wagon to. But meanwhile, Ron Paul is converting people to peace. That's the deal. They ask him, USA Today specifically, for example, ask him, man, why don't you just tone down the foreign policy peacenik stuff a little bit in order to, you know, attain power? And he said, that's the last thing I'm going to do. He's here to get you to support him. If he's got to change your mind to get you to support him, that's what he wants. For you to realize that, no, you don't have to be a big, fat hypocrite like Michael Moore, who praises it like a little lapdog, his dear leader Barack Obama, the child killer, who actually, as we speak right now, is burning little Pakistani kids to death. Oh, but nah, he's a good guy. Barack Obama, he's got a D by his name. You don't have to be like that to be anti-war. In fact, you can hardly call that anti-war at all, can you? So, yeah, you don't have to be like Michael Moore. What a great piece of propaganda he is for the National Review and Weekly Standard crowd, huh? For the American Enterprise Institute special interests. You got your son fighting over there. What a great piece of propaganda he is for them. Big, fat hypocrite. Whiner. And they just say, well, if you're anti-war, you're like him. And it sticks. But now here comes Ron Paul going, no, you can be anti-war and be like me. I'm a conservative Christian Texas Republican congressman who always votes no on spending bills and taxes. And they go, hey, all right. This guy makes Thomas Jefferson look like Benito Mussolini. Think maybe we could do this. Maybe we don't need to conquer the world. What if Bill Clinton had had 3 terms instead of just 2? And the whole war, you know, Bush Jr.'s war on terror had been Bill Clinton's war on terror. Would any of it have been legitimate at all? Or would it have just been one big catastrophe, right? Okay, there you go. Same thing. And same thing the other way, too. But anyway, so I think it's great that now Perry's out and Perry's endorsed Gingrich. That ought to help Gingrich in South Carolina. If he can get this kind of temporary bump thing, that's great because all it does is hurt Mitt. But then Newt Gingrich ain't going anywhere anyway because the more people get to know him, the less they like him. I didn't see the clip, but I read about it where they asked him about, man, you really think that... all the janitors ought to be fired and all the kids in public school ought to be made indentured servants to clean the schools if they're poor and black and whatever. And he doubled down on it and said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And now here's my thing about that. I don't know what job is good for anyone. That's why it's their life and not mine. But here's what I do know. No president should be concerned about what's going on inside a local public school anywhere. How in the hell would that be any of his business? How in the hell is it conservatism for Newt Gingrich to have a federal opinion about how every aspect of our society is run? And here's a guy who, at least in times past, he wouldn't trumpet his own horn this loud now. I hope not. But here's a guy who's spoken in the past about building a new civilization on the planet Earth. It's not just the West anymore, it's the world now. And we will lead. Like, dude, who do you think you are? You big, fat-headed bully. Nobody likes you. So he's not going anywhere. So I say, I'm just happy to see him hurt Romney. Because Ron Paul's just, he's doing the Barack Obama electoral strategy, which is collect delegates. Run every race. And work real hard and collect delegates. And we all remember how it was in 2007. Oh, Hillary Clinton is obviously going to be the nominee. Hillary Clinton, she's a shoo-in. I mean, John Edwards and Barack Obama. Yeah, right, it's got to be Hillary Clinton. Go ahead and hold the coronation now. Everybody knows Hillary Clinton is going to be the one because Hillary Clinton's the one and everybody knows that. And then what happened? She lost. Turns out, no. So they don't really know. And the truth is, I got to hand it to, I don't know, however it worked out. Sort of kind of the Constitutional Convention, that it is really within the realm of possibility that the American people using their one man, one vote could do the right thing and elect the peace, Bill of Rights, sound economy guy. I'm skeptical, but it does seem possible. You know, Barack Obama had the support of half of the Democratic Party going into that thing. Basically, everybody who wasn't a Clintonite and was sick and tired of the Clintons inside the Democratic Party, they got on board for Barack Obama. Now, Ron Paul certainly has a much steeper hill to climb when it comes to dealing with the Republican Party. After all, when Newt Gingrich was the Speaker, he abolished the House Subcommittee on Monetary Policy just to deny the chairmanship to Ron Paul. He organized for himself and other congressmen to travel to Texas to campaign for Ron Paul's primary opponents. Had his henchmen like Tom DeLay redraw the district to try to get rid of the conservative votes. And try to, kick him out of his own district, in his congressional district in Texas. The Republican establishment has always hated this guy. And it would take a huge groundswell, double what we got now, by the American people insisting and demanding it for them to change or just cease to exist. And we're not there yet, but maybe it could happen, because after all, look who he's up against. I mean, Newt Gingrich is pathetic. And I'm sorry to just call names and be mean, but he's too mean. He's like Hillary Clinton, dude, is what he is, in drag. Takes a village to raise your family, is his whole way of thinking. There has never been a conversation had where he didn't have an opinion about the solution to how it should be for everyone. Always. And he wears it. He ought to have like a big sash, leader, like Mayor Quimby or something, you know? He's ridiculous. And then nobody likes Romney. They just don't like him. Now he's the default, and he does have $200 million in his bank account, so that ain't nothing. But, and I don't think Santorum has legs, because, I don't know. I guess if you get kind of the default Republican voter, pro-war vote, if it's decided by media and party leadership, and maybe they don't need a good ground game. They'll just coalesce. But it seems like Ron Paul sort of kind of has a shot, especially if Gingrich and Romney stay at it. I thought Gingrich was going to lose here pretty bad and have to drop out. But if he wins South Carolina, it could be really good for Ron Paul. More anti-war speeches, yeah? All right. The following statement is true, and it ought to stick. This whole thing about Iran has weapons of mass destruction, and we got to do something about it, is just like Iraq. It's the same thing again. It just isn't true. It's all a bunch of hype, a bunch of lying war propaganda. And they try to scare you, and they try to not really confuse you so much as get you to give up. They want you to say to yourself, you know, nuclear this and that is too complicated for me. So, if people say nuclear is scary in Iran, I guess nuclear is scary in Iran. Same thing as with Iraq. You know, Dick Cheney said they are reconstituting nuclear weapons. And then, we believe they have reconstituted nuclear weapons. Even though they had never constituted nuclear weapons there in Iraq. But anyway, it didn't matter. And the aluminum tubes that everybody knew was even in the Post. Everybody knew they were just for regular rockets mounted from the backs of trucks, like on the A-Team or whatever. They weren't for centrifuges for weapons-grade uranium that was not being enriched anywhere in Iraq, please. And they knew they were lying. They were just lying. Now, in the case of Iran, they do have a nuclear program, but they're not making weapons. As, again, even the Washington Post happened to admit in a recent story, as I was mentioning on the show earlier, are members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says they promise to not buy or develop nuclear weapons. They promise not to divert any of their nuclear material to any military or other special purpose, and they allow, by way of a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, a permanent routine of inspections to verify the non-diversion of their declared nuclear material. In other words, they're just in a nuclear weapons program there. Now, for me, I don't care if they got 100 hydrogen bombs. I'm just telling you they don't, and that the people who say, oh no, Iran nuclear is scary, actually are all liars. They are liars. And I'm sorry, because you're not supposed to say mean things about people, but they're damned liars. And I'll give you an example. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State. Gareth Porter, January 12, 2012, Clinton revives dubious charge of covert Iranian nuclear site. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's charge Tuesday that Iran had intended to keep the Fordo site secret until it was revealed by Western intelligence revived a claim the Barack Obama administration made in September 2009. Clinton said Iran, quote, only declared the COM facility to the IAEA after it was discovered by the international community following 3 years of covert construction. She also charged that there is no, quote, plausible reason for Iran to enrich to a 20% level at the Fordo plant, implying that the only explanation is an intent to make nuclear weapons. And then, of course, Gareth Porter goes on to remind us how that's just not true. And they never explained how it was that Iran supposedly knew that the CIA, that Barack Obama, in his joint press conference with Nicolas Sarkozy and David Cameron, was supposed to, how they were supposed to know that they were about to be called out for their secret construction of this atom bomb factory. They never explained that. They just asserted, nonsensically, okay, it's true that even though the Iranians declared this site 4 days before we called them on it, they only did so because they knew we were about to call them on it. And yet they never explained how in the world it supposedly was. Did the Iranians have a mole inside the French speechwriter collective there in the Prime Minister, President, French President's office? Who had compromised security and warned them that in 4 days they're going to call you out for this secret thing that everybody knows they've been building for years and years. The CIA had come out with their, and not just the CIA, the National Intelligence Council, that is the leadership of all American intelligence agencies, reportedly 16 or 17 or so, agreed long after the construction on this Fordo COM facility began, that they have not made the decision to begin making nuclear weapons. The unanimous opinion of the American intelligence communities is that the construction of this plant does not necessarily indicate a nuclear weapons program. So Hillary Clinton is, one, pretending that they never said that, and then, two, they're pretending that, you know, time in the line. I mean, and okay, there's wormholes and whatever, but at least, you know, out of my two eyes, if Iran tells the IAEA, hey, at least 6 months from now, we're going to introduce nuclear material into this facility, thought you might like to know, like in the deal, and then 4 days later, Barack Obama pretends to bust them with some secret program and reveal it, and the New York Times goes along with it, then that's just not true. That's lies posing as truth and should not be the basis for discussion among adults or anybody else. And most especially the Secretary of State. But, you know, in the next hour, we'll be talking with Philip Giraldi about, well, the same topic we talked with Gareth Porter about yesterday, about Israel murdering scientists in Iran, not because that's going to, you know, really cripple their ability to, you know, have their nuclear program there. It's not. But because it makes it impossible for the Ayatollah to authorize real concessions and talks with the American Empire, which has an unlimited list of demands. They can't do it. The enemy, and we've been covering this on this show for years, since whenever, dude, since the weekend interview show in 2004 at least, 2005. The enemy of the American war party in Iran is not the Ayatollah, it's the moderates. Their enemy is anybody who's a friendly face on the Iranian regime that seems on American TV like maybe we could shake hands and work out something with these guys so that we don't have to have a war with them. And their goal all along has been to, well, take for example how when Rafsanjani and Katami when they were the presidents. They were kind of mild-mannered, sort of friendly faces anyway for American media consumption. I'm not saying they were great men or anything like that. Just they looked plausible for a 60 Minutes interview or whatever, not raving lunatics like Ahmadinejad. Well, back then, they would always emphasize the Ayatollah because he looked scarier with his beard and his weird hat and his, you know, religious, theocratic, political authority up there, you know? And so they would always highlight him as opposed to these sort of moderate, modern-seeming leaders who were trying to do some reforms and maybe could be negotiated with. But then after George Bush said, you better not elect a right-winger, in July of 2005, and all of the Iranian right-wingers came out to vote in response and put Ahmadinejad in there, well, then they've taken the spotlight pretty much off the Ayatollah, who, after all, isn't really that reminiscent of the Ayatollah Khomeini from the revolution in the 1980s, who's long dead now. But this guy, Ahmadinejad, always says something asinine and horrible, and so he's great for quoting and misquoting and just spotlighting. He doesn't seem that impressive and powerful, really, but he does seem a bit unhinged, which I guess suits the purpose well enough. And anything that they can do, for example, like backing Jandala assassinations and that kind of thing, serves to weaken any real dissident movements in that country. Because all the regime has to do is say, and in fact they don't even have to say it, it's just assumed that any significant dissident movement against the current government's power there is a CIA plot. And the more they're people are getting assassinated, or a Mossad plot, either way, the more their people get assassinated, the more bombs go off, and their soldiers and policemen, think of how, you know, in America, how people feel about soldiers and policemen. They're the very best of us. They're the bravest who go out to protect us from the bad guys and whatever. Well, that's how they feel about their cops and soldiers, too, over there. And whoever's running Jandala over there has them kidnapping and executing these guys. What do you think that does for their internal politics? That this is what, this is, I wonder what America and Israel have in mind for us. Well, let's see, they just kidnapped a bunch of your cops and cut their heads off. How about that? You trust them yet? Oh good, here come the Americans. And the Israelis, the same ones who used to back the Shah over us. And now back Jandala, who cuts our cops' heads off. Yeah, pretty soon we'll be good friends with them. Again. Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Okay, more on Iran nuclear hype and nonsense and terrorism and assassinations and craziness with Phil Giraldi. At the bottom of the hour. He'll be joining us here in half an hour, 20 minutes, something like that. This one's by Jason from the 6th of January. Sorry, it's out of date, but it's still important to me, so. And it's still going on. Ethiopia to hand over occupied portion of Somalia to the African Union. With the African Union's AMISOM force in Somalia looking to grow considerably with the integration of the Kenyan invasion force, they also seem poised to make a territorial gain as the Ethiopian military is said to be planning to hand over a portion of the country they occupied to AU control. The portion of the country is relatively small, but includes the key central town of Beledweyne, which the Ethiopian military occupied over the weekend. The town is near Ethiopia's borders and has often fell during the intermittent Ethiopian invasion. With the absorption of the Kenyan troops, the AU force could become as large as nearly 18,000 fighters, though it is still pending UN approval, as much of the force is funded by the international community. Despite the ever-growing size of the force, the AU still has no territory outside of Mogadishu, and it is unclear if they will be able to retain control over the region handed over by Ethiopia. Since Beledweyne has been occupied at least three times by Ethiopia, and always fell within months to one insurgent faction or another. History is not on the AU's side. And this is all America's doing. You know, if there was anything like fairness and proportion in the American media, this would be a major issue being used against the President of the United States right now, is continuing George Bush's policy in Somalia. Leave these people alone, man. God. And you know what? You'd have to go back a few pages, but if you look at the anti-war blog, antiwar.com/blog, you can find a piece there by John Glazer, where he quotes Barack Obama saying, I forget, it's a very close paraphrase, I think, that like, you know, we risk, if we intervene too much in Somalia, we risk blowback that could hurt Americans here at home. The president himself admitted that. I mean, I don't know exactly what numbers to believe, because there are various ones, but at least a handful of Americans, Somali Americans from the Minneapolis area, have gone to Somalia to fight on the side of al-Shabaab. And I don't know, I really need to get somebody on from something to explain the truth about the populations in the refugee camps and the state of the famine and all these things. There's very little real reporting out of there, at least where I know how to find it. I guess I should look at allafrica.com more often. They got some stuff. But, you know, all indications are that their entire economy and division of labor and distribution systems for getting what little food is actually being grown to marketplace and whatever, is it's all been smashed by America's war there. And it's just, it's so unfair, man, picking on Somalia. They were actually doing all right for the first time in a long time before America intervened. And you can read all about it in the Military Times. They actually did a lot of really great reporting. Well, it's full of, you know, official spin. That's fine. But there are a lot of facts in their journalism about American intervention there. And then the masterpiece, the very best single article about American intervention in Somalia, you get your hands on it and get it taken care of in 15, 20 minutes or something if you want to read careful. And that's Jeremy Scahill in The Nation. And the article is called Blowback in Somalia. First, I think he rushed the, he didn't want to bury the lead. He came out with his initial piece, which was the CIA's secret sites in Somalia. Yes, I have to say it slow or it won't work. And that was about how the Central Intelligence Agency and the Joint Special Operations Command are keeping a secret torture dungeon beneath Mogadishu. Like something out of a Far Side cartoon, only with real grief and pain. Right? Get it? Enhanced interrogations and stuff like that. You know, the Bradley Manning treatment. And so he well, I won't say rushed in like a sloppy way, certainly not, but he hurried up and got that most important headline out. But then he came out with the real piece. Jeremy Scahill at thenation.com. Blowback in Somalia. And then, so you read that, and then you see that Barack Obama is continuing to support Ethiopia and now Kenya. Well, I should say, now Kenya and now Ethiopia again in intervening and invading Somalia when all they've ever done is create more enemies there. It's hard to believe it's not a deliberate application of that insurgent math touted by General McChrystal. For every one we kill, we get 10 more. What a great way to wage war forever. And after all, it's only at the expense of people that the American people couldn't care less about. Go ahead and burn them all to death slow as far as the American people are concerned, right? Isn't that how you feel about the people of Somalia? You don't care if Barack Obama uses droids to murder each and every last one of them, do you? Never did. Hell, nobody put up a fuss, hardly, except Chris Floyd and antiwar.com. When George Bush invaded in 2006. And no, that's not true. Human Rights Watch did some good stuff about the consequences of it. And by the way, Chris Floyd is absolutely heroic on the topic of America's intervention in Somalia. And, I mean, man, there were American citizens who were renditioned to Ethiopia by the CIA. Some real bad times. Anyway, Jason Ditz does a hell of a job covering it at news.antiwar.com. Much as he can. And now, man, I got to get one of these. I really blew it, actually. I was talking to tech genius Jason Ditz earlier in the show, and I really should ask him about this, probably instead of Libya this time. Obama to hand Commerce Department authority over cybersecurity ID. And this is where they want to, I guess, make, you know, your webcam, your mark. Oh, it'll save you from having to remember all those passwords. And yes, we have to make sure to, you know, make it deniable by coming up with some complicated system to make it seem private, when really all it is your single government password for everything you do online. It'll be great. The government cannot create that identity infrastructure. If it tried to, it wouldn't be trusted. So we'll just outsource it, even though it's all about the Department of Homeland Security. And the lawless slave state. And that's the whole thing, you know, technology is going to be invented, and it's hard to stop it, and things get cheaper and cheaper. But this is the reason for the importance of the old law, you know? This is the reason for the importance of the principles put in, say, for example, the Fourth Amendment. At the time of the Fourth Amendment, the people were just as heavily armed as the government. So they kind of had to concede that much, you know? So this is why we got to fight to keep that old law, because at this point, without it, we're like living in Gattaca or something. I could have picked a better dystopia than that, sorry. That's a Declan McCullough, Obama to hand Commerce Department authority over cybersecurity ID. Very important stuff. Check it out. CNET.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to Santa War Radio. Now, this one's from yesterday, right? Yeah. Headline reads, back from Libya, Tuareg rebels aim to capture much of northern Mali. Clashes reported in several towns. Now I say stop right there. Wait a minute. How in the hell is this news to me? It must have something to do with the United States government. Because I've never heard of these things. No, that's not true. I don't really know where they are, though. I admit that to you, you know? Thank goodness a map has been included. Fighting has broken out across northern Mali as ethnic Tuareg rebels recently returned from fighting in Libya attempt to flush out Malian troops. A rebel spokesman says they plan to capture a number of towns across the region. Clashes were reported in several towns, including the key town of Manaka, near the border with Niger. The Malian army has increased its presence in the region in anticipation of the battles intensifying. U.S.-backed Mali and neighboring Mauritania have already been battling an Al-Qaeda-branded insurgency. A number of the Tuareg fighters have recently returned from Libya, where they were employed as mercenaries for the Gaddafi regime in the lead-up to the NATO attack on that country. Many are said to have returned with their weapons and moved straight for fighting for autonomy from Malian authority. Fighters aim to free the people of Azawad from the illegal occupation of its territory. The people of Azawad. From the illegal occupation of its territory, said a press release from the Northern Mali Tuareg movement. The Azawad is an area of northern Africa inhabited primarily by the Tuareg under the domination of several nation-states. Most Tuareg live inside Mali, making up roughly 7% of the country's population. With a strong emphasis on warrior culture, a well-armed Tuareg rebellion could pose a serious problem for Mali's rulers. Huh. It's up a little kind of group of stateless Kurds. It's the symptom of the old world, right? Ethnicity is everything. So the Europeans come in and draw their own lines all across Africa with primarily, a divide-and-conquer strategy in mind as they drew them. You have all these different warring tribal and ethnic and whatever kind of weird differentiations people make from each other, you know, all stuck inside old borders. And, it's one of those things. I'm not saying this is necessarily bad for the Americans. I'm for only nonviolent, consensual interactions between people. So, if people can get rid of what they consider a foreign occupation, that's cool. But it sure seems a shame because you're never going to have, like, one magic I dream of genie moment where all the borders now reflect where these tribes actually live and in the most fair way possible or whatever. I think the only way out of it is individualism. Boy, it's going to be a long time coming. But it's also, it just goes to show, you know, dominoes falling down, not necessarily ones that will empower communist China, but just dominoes, unintended consequences of wars. I mean, seriously, if you missed it earlier, we're talking with Jason Ditz a little bit about what's going on in Libya. And now maybe this is just war propaganda. I don't want to make too much of it necessarily. But as Pepe Escobar explained on the show back then, the guy that me and Jason were talking about, this guy, Hakim al-Balhaj, the CIA and the MI6, I guess, kidnapped and renditioned this guy to Thailand, where they tortured him in a dungeon underground. And then they sent him back to Libya, where he's from, to Muammar Gaddafi to torture for 4 years. And then he got out. And now he's the leader of the rebellion that Barack Obama and Nicolas Sarkozy and David Cameron, right, over there in Britain, waged this NATO war in Libya. And he's now the leader of one of the most powerful factions. And who knows who they all are? I sure as hell don't. But according to Time magazine, which is suspicious, in Libya, a fundamentalist war against moderate Islam takes shape. Now, to the degree that this is meant to justify further intervention by the United States to make sure that the people that they help win the war don't win the war, that's a bad time. To the degree it's true, it's just more I told you so. And I don't know, man. The war in Libya. Remember, I predicted about 11 months ago or whatever it was, 10, that we would, the United States would be intervening in Libya for the long term. If it comes to ground troops taking Tripoli or whatever, they'll have to do it at some point. Can they just let tribal war and chaos reign? Then again, have they learned the lesson that they can't do anything about that once they sponsor regime change? Iraq, Afghanistan, now Libya. Once you see that now, you topple governments, you don't know exactly what you're going to get, but it's not what you thought. But yeah, the Hillary Clinton, man, she sure does believe in herself. I'll give her that, you know? She's really got a great amount of self-esteem, and I admire that in a leader. But, anyway, so a step backwards for modernity and liberty, perhaps. And all just to what? To try to have a backup for cutting off our own supply, or not even ours, Europe's supply of Iranian oil. Is it worth all that? It's funny to me, but not that funny. And yeah, you know, I think kind of like I was lamenting back in 2002, wow, can't believe they're really going to do this. You know, there's going to be consequences of this invasion of Iraq that they're doing here, this bonus extra war they're getting away with. This thing is going to reverberate for decades and maybe centuries and things. Like, this is really a bad idea. I'm not sure. It seems like if that Scott Bakula dude could go back in time, he would change it. But it's probably too late for that. Or too early for him to have the machine necessary. So I guess it could still happen. Yeah, we probably shouldn't hold our breath, so. All right, well, you can count on Phil Giraldi's going to be on the show here in just a few minutes, and he's going to say intelligent things. I imagine, you know, I anticipate, about American intervention in Iran. And maybe a little bit of this Military Detainment Act. And the Mavi Marmara, huh? Check out his new article at antiwar.com right now. It's at the very top of the page. We'll be back right after this, y'all. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA counterterrorism officer and contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine, contributing writer, regular contributor or something, antiwar.com, of course, original.antiwar.com/Giraldi, and he's the executive editor of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. Welcome back to the show, Phil.
Hi, Scott.
Appreciate you joining us today. So Foreign Policy Magazine online came out with this article about John Dalla, the, well, I'll let you go ahead and describe him, I guess, this terrorist group operating inside Iran, and the story is that perhaps we were wrong. We thought the CIA was backing these guys all this time, but really it was Mossad pretending to be CIA, and we all had bad information or something. What's going on here?
Well, I think it's kind of like peeling an onion. You know, there are layers to this that it depends. I've been looking very carefully at some of the comments coming out from the government on what has been going on. They haven't really been very forthcoming, I must admit, but Hillary keeps declaring, generically speaking, we haven't been involved with assassinating Iranian scientists, we haven't been involved with this, that, and the other thing. Well, the fact is, you know, we are involved, but the question is, who's pulling the trigger in some of these cases? In this case, the John Dalla, which there has been a lot of evidence, has been supported both by the Pakistanis and the U.S., it now appears that they were, in some cases at least, being directed by Israeli case officers using U.S. passports and pretending to be CIA. Nobody's denied the report, and apparently it's quite true. I had a piece in the American Conservative magazine back in September 2010, which reported that Israeli intelligence officers in the U.S. were approaching U.S. citizens, Arab Americans, and were obtaining their cooperation by pretending to be FBI or pretending to be CIA. So, you know, these accounts have been out there for a while.
Well, but that's still running John Dalla inside Iran in the name of the U.S. or NATO, I guess, as they claim. But now, Seymour Hersh, I guess, you know, Gareth was on the show yesterday, Gareth Porter, yeah, from IPS News, and he said that, yeah, you know, this all sounded plausible to him. But I guess he seemed to think that the origin of the story, that it was the CIA that was backing John Dalla and not the Israelis, was simply the lies of the Israelis, and that John Dalla went bragging that they were sponsored by the CIA, and that was the word that got back to Seymour Hersh and Andrew Coburn and to you, because you've been reporting that America's CIA has been backing them for a couple of years anyway, right? Or not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my sources basically were that John Dalla was carrying out these operations and they were being supported by the United States government. Now, I think even at the time, as I think back, a lot of the assumption was that they were really being run by somebody else, like the Pakistanis, or, you know, Mossad really didn't come up because it would seem to be fairly far-fetched for Mossad officers to be able to operate in that part of the world. So, you know, but I think that the consensus has to be here that, yeah, Jundallah has been supported by somebody, and basically they've been carrying out terror operations inside Iran. Obviously, there are a number of possible players who have an interest in doing that.
And so is it the consensus then that Jundallah are the guys driving up on motorcycles and bombing Iranian scientists?
No, I don't think so. I think that's another story. That's I think that's either I think that's people that have been recruited by either CIA or Mossad and been trained and sent back into Iran. I believe they're Iranians or Persians. Otherwise, they would have trouble operating inside Iran. And I suspect they were recruited out of MEK, which is why we're seeing so much stuff in support of MEK coming out of various politicians and other interest groups, because MEK is kind of their boys, their cutting edge in terms of getting inside Iran and carrying out these kind of operations. It's funny, but, you know, having been an experienced CIA case officer, I understand how this stuff works a lot better than somebody in a newspaper. And the fact is that a guy like me or a Mossad officer doesn't have the ability to go inside Iran and carry out an operation. So you've got to acquire somebody else who can do it for you. And in this case, there are some obvious candidates. MEK would be, I think, the most prominent. It's probably slightly less possible that it could be some Kurdish groups. But the same kind of dynamic, people who speak the local language, who more or less can fit in.
Well, I guess they're, according to this article, Bush was really mad about this. He went absolutely ballistic that the Israelis were posing as Americans and recruiting these, as Bush would have called them, Al-Qaeda-tied terrorists against Iran under his nose without his authority.
Yeah, that's what the article says, and Mark Perry is the author of the article, and he is he's a meticulous researcher and a checker of facts. So I have to believe that that's correct, and that means that the story about Israel being involved with Jundallah using the fake documents has been around for a while. It just hasn't surfaced.
So would you agree with Garrett that the purpose of this is just to marginalize the moderates and make any type of reasonable negotiation impossible?
I don't know. I think it's more complicated than that. I think the idea of I did a piece for Anti-War on secret wars back about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I think.
Right, about the two new findings.
Yeah, and the findings. And I think the idea is, in the case of Iran, in the case of Syria, they want to overthrow the regime. In the case of Iran, they know they're not going to overthrow the regime, and I think it's just a question of setting up a bunch of relationships and employing various covert actions to destabilize, to make the Iranian government waste a lot of resources on dealing with these problems. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably more so what it is.
Yeah, well, John Glazer pointed out in one of his pieces that, yeah, look how completely ineffectual the Iranian FBI is, whatever it is. Their counterintelligence agency is getting pantsed over and over again over there right now.
Well, I don't know
buildings
how true that is.
Buildings blowing up and yeah. Scientists dying.
I don't know how true that is. I mean, it's what I hear when I talk to Iranians is that the police state there is pretty effective. The fact that these operations are being pulled off, it implies that there's a certain level of sophistication. They claim to have caught some people earlier this week, but the report never followed up with any names or identities, as far as I can tell. But you can argue on one level that they seem to be somewhat ineffective. But nevertheless, I mean, to carry out an operation like this, and one has to consider that there's a certain level of sophistication to it. It means that these people were pretty well prepared on the outside and probably sent in, and they had infrastructure with them. But they had to be people that mixed in locally and that were indistinguishable from the local population. And otherwise, it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm. Now, they say in here, I believe Mark Perry writes that the Iranians were mad because the Pakistanis government didn't crack down on Jundallah like they promised they would. Is that just they want to deflect these guys across their western border if they got to deal with them at all, or what's going on there?
Well, I'm not sure what that means, but you know, I have been hearing for years that the PACs were kind of in bed with us in terms of using Jindala. So I think that you know, this is kind of a, maybe on the part of the Iranians, a diplomatic way of saying that, you know, we know you're involved with this. I'm not sure what that means, to be honest.
Well, now these guys, I guess it shouldn't go without saying or anything, that apparently they do suicide bombings, and they like to kidnap cops and soldiers and kill them, shoot them in the back of the head or cut their heads off, these kinds of things. These are, you know, what we'd have called the worst enemies in the worst days of the Iraq War, of course, just like them.
Yeah.
Zarqawi types.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, now hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Phil Giraldi after this. Original.antiwar.com/Giraldi. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi from the American Conservative at antiwar.com and the Council for the National Interest Foundation. His latest piece is Creating American Terrorists, which I hope we'll have a minute to talk about that in a minute. But the one before that is What War with Iran Might Look Like. And my segue to that is this Wall Street Journal piece about how President Obama himself and the Secretary of Defense have personally called Benjamin Netanyahu and other political and military leaders in Israel and told them to not get us into a war. Is it really like that? They're begging, please don't give our sanctions more time to work at whatever it is they're supposed to do. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think it is. I think the issue here is that, as I think I've said every time we've discussed this on your show, I don't think Obama wants a war with Iran. I think that's the last thing he wants. But, you know, he's under pressure to make it look as if he's willing to do so. And it was interesting just before Christmas, I think, or maybe just after, when Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, said that the red line for the United States with Iran, meaning the point at which we would have to would feel compelled to take military action, was if Iran actually possessed a nuclear weapon. Now, that's kind of, you know, walked the dog back a bit, because it used to be that was just the capability was the thing that, and this was the Israeli line pretty much that we were aping. But now it's clear that, to me anyway, that the administration is trying very hard to avoid this and avoid a war.
Well, that's good, but how worried are they that Netanyahu will really drag them kicking and screaming into a war, Phil, you think?
They must be seriously worried. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing these kinds of things. And you're quite right, they have only limited ability to pressure Israel into doing anything. And so I think they are genuinely worried. I'm doing a piece right now for the American Conservative, which will be out early next week, about how the National Security Agency has been monitoring Israeli military transmissions and has seen a surge in these transmissions, which normally indicates that some kind of military action is impending. But the analysts in Washington are all divided as to who the target is. Is it Lebanon? Is it Gaza? Or is it Iran? Nobody knows.
Yeah. And more frank admissions, echoing really what Netanyahu and Ehud Barak told Jeffrey Goldberg back, I guess, a year and a half ago, that they didn't really fear an Iranian first strike. They just were worried that their ability to act in Lebanon and in Palestine would be limited. And the Israeli army chief has echoed that same thing, as reported by the Associated Press this week. And so it seems like there really is a little bit of a pushback. The Washington Post chose to reprint this one and highlight it. I guess maybe wishful thinking that there's a little bit of pushback from the American establishment about this. Like, hey, we said no, okay? Something like that, maybe?
Yeah, I think there's considerable pushback coming from the Pentagon and from the intelligence agencies. And you know, of course, that the Pentagon canceled a joint exercise with Israel, scheduled for April, I think. And so there's considerable pushback, and people are waking up to the fact that war with Iran would, first of all, not be easy, and secondly, could have very serious negative consequences for the United States. I think people are starting to figure that one out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's funny because on TV, the way it works, the consensus is, well, something's got to be done about it, and it just sort of goes without saying that this one will be great. Everybody will love this war. It'll be just fine. Don't worry about any negative consequences of it because they just never come up at all. But then when Ron Paul says, we don't need another war, the way he says it, people go, hey, yeah, I think maybe that guy's right. Yep. Maybe it didn't work out so well the last time, man. Maybe he's getting through to some.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think that as somnolent as the American public is on most issues, I think that the evidence is there that what happened in Iraq was not really a good thing for us, and what's happening in Afghanistan is not a good thing. And so the thought of, you know, tripling down on a war just in hopes that it'll turn out better against a country that's much bigger, more populous, and much better armed and prepared than either of the previous adversaries is kind of getting through, I think.
Mm. Well, you know, the already kind of pre-coronated Republican front runner, Mitt Romney, has made Iran his number one issue, that Barack Obama has been so weak on this when, you know, you would think that weakness could have been translated into a willingness to negotiate, but nah, he just does everything wrong with all the sanctions and all the threats and still is, you know, criticized this week. That's like Romney's leading issue, as MJ Rosenberg is writing this week. That's more important than the economy to Mitt Romney's campaign right now.
Yeah, and the scary thing, of course, is that a lot of Romney's advisors are neocons. So we're going to get the same kind of logic telling us that this is what we should do because we have to do it in terms of our national interest. And certainly nobody in Romney's campaign is going to be challenging that.
All right, now, in this piece at antiwar.com, Phil, you write, what war with Iran might look like. And this one gets all the way to a pretty big, you know, uranium fission thing going on there by the end. It doesn't necessarily have to be quite that bad to be pretty bad the way you describe not just, you know, likely, but extremely probable immediate consequences within weeks of a real American and or Israeli war with Iran. Can you take us through some of that?
Well, basically, I hypothesized that a small incident, because the atmosphere is so charged, a small incident could easily escalate into something much bigger. That's the premise of the piece. And it essentially says that, you know, the situation could develop and suddenly things get out of control. I was actually fairly generous in the piece, as it turns out. We had some people commenting on it who pointed out that, in fact, the Iranians have major capabilities in terms of swarming small boats, as they describe it, and also in terms of some missile technologies to sink U.S. warships, not to mention tankers. And so this whole threat of closing the Straits of Hormuz is a very serious one if there were a war, and would probably come about. But then the issue becomes, for me, which I tried to lay out in the article, is once you start a war like this, how do you stop it? And the only option that I can see that the U.S. has, if it started a war with Iran and felt it had gone far enough, would be to say, hey, if you don't stop right now, we're going to nuke you. And at that point, the Iranian response would almost certainly be, to hell with you. And then what would we do? And, of course, once you start that game, the war becomes a lot bigger thing, and you have nuclear-armed Pakistan and India right on the border there. You have numerous other issues. And basically, you know, I could see how something like this could turn out into something like World War III. And it's scary as hell. And as you probably noted, the piece, when it appeared in Anti-War, went kind of crazy. I think we got about 100 comments on it, which is very unusual. And it played all over the internet. So this is something people should be thinking about. It, that, you know, this whole idea of a surgical strike, a contained war, is a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, it's just really the perfect kind of irony. I mean, even really unlike Iraq, I don't think you could quite say this about Iraq, is a situation where They are not the threat they're being portrayed as that we have to preempt by a million miles. And yet, they're just powerful enough to fight back like hell in an asymmetric kind of fashion. They can't really come here. I guess I will ask you to comment on whether, you know, Hamas cigarette salesmen can, you know, wage attacks here in the United States. But mostly, what they can do is screw up the American empire over there. And as you're saying, perhaps even worse. But they could cost all of America's everything in the Gulf, for example, as you describe it in this article.
Yeah, they clearly could. I mean, let's face it. I mean, they do have resources. And as you say, they're asymmetrical. But they, like, for example, Hezbollah could inflict serious damage on Israel before being bombed into the Stone Age. But, I mean, they could inflict serious damage. And there would certainly be terrorist attacks inside the United States. There would certainly be terrorist attacks throughout the Middle East region and probably all over Europe. So it's, you know, this is serious stuff.
Man. All right, y'all. You heard it. Phil Giraldi, original.antiwar.com/Giraldi. Check him out at the Council for the National Interest Foundation, where he's the executive director, and also the American Conservative Magazine.com. Thanks, Phil.